Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show.
Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, and this week my guest is Grammy-nominated recording artist, violinist, mandolinist, composer, educator, Sarah Caswell. Welcome. Oh,
thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you. I think the first time I met you was years ago in Detroit or in Lansing or somewhere like that. It was associated with the IAJE, the International Association of Jazz Educators. Yeah. It was a Sisters in Jazz concert, Sonny Wilkinson and Ingrid Jensen. And gosh, I can't remember who else. Marion Hayton, I think, were involved in mentoring the women in the group, at least for part of the time. I'm not sure exactly how that rotation worked, but you all were doing a concert. Right. And I got a chance to hear you. And I think you did McCoy Tyner's Blues on the Corner.
And, oh my gosh.
And I stole that from you. As soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, that's hip. I performed it for years after that. So I was like, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that was back in 98 at the time, IAJE, which is the International Association for Jazz Education. They had a competition of sorts for women collegiate jazz musicians. And that was the first year they did it, the inaugural year. And so it was a group of, I think there were five of us. So it was me, Anat Cohen, Jody Prosnick, Don Clement, and I'm forgetting the drummer's name. It's escaping me right now. But our coach, Lorraine Faina, that was who our drummer was. And our coach was Ingrid Jensen. And at the time, I think Sonny Wilkinson was supervising it. She was the one who was really very much present, kind of was there in a daily way. But we met during that. Well, actually, I guess it was for a couple of days before the conference to rehearse and hang. And then we presented our set of music during the convention. And then following the convention, we did a few concerts in the U.S. I think one of them was in Detroit. And it was an old, old dance hall. It was just beautiful in the downtown area. And yeah, that was one of our first concerts we did together. But yeah, we had a really fun run. And the cool thing was, I think there's something always very special when you get a group of women like that together, and especially since we're not accustomed to being in an all-female jazz ensemble. So there was that unique and really memorable experience being there and sort of feeling that kind of connection and sisterhood that developed from it. But there was also, I think, just that bonding that came from it being the first year and realizing that this was hopefully the first of many opportunities for young jazz musicians to connect and to really feel how that femininity can get into the music and really create some beautiful things. So we're all still very close. It's pretty remarkable, actually, given how many years have passed and how many miles are between us. But yeah, we still are certainly connected on Facebook and you know, Instagram and all the social media. And whenever there's an opportunity to connect at different jazz conferences and festivals, yeah, it's like when we see each other, it's like no time has passed. You know, we very instantly, you know, just reconnect. So it's great.
Very great. Very great. So you were at school at that time. Where were you studying at that point?
I was doing my undergraduate degree at Indiana University, my hometown. So I was doing a dual degree. I was doing a bachelor's in violin performance, so more of the classical side of things. And then I was also doing a bachelor's in jazz violin. Mm. So yeah, it was a really wonderful environment for me to be in. I mean, first of all, of course, I knew the town really well. I grew up there. My father was a professor there. But even with that aside, like if I just had dropped in from another town, the environment that the school had and has was ideal for what I was wanting to do. Because I really, you know, I loved playing classical music. I was in a lot of competitions and performances and loved that aspect of my music, musical upbringing. But I also was obviously loving jazz and was loving the music I was learning from David Baker, who was head of the department at the time. And I've been studying with him since I was about 8 or 9. So I'd grown up learning about this music and playing it. And it, most of the schools, when it came time to decide where I wanted to go, most schools would want me to make a decision. They were like, you have to do one or the other. And that wasn't me. And I wasn't sure exactly how these musics would sort of come together. If they would come together, I wasn't quite sure how that would materialize, but I certainly wasn't ready to make a decision one way or the other. And so IU was one of the few schools that allowed me to do a double major. And that was exactly what I needed to really sort of go my own way and with the guidance of the professors there and kind of figure out in my own time how my music would develop and where that would lead. So,
oh, that's great. I mean, to have that kind of support is pretty amazing because, yeah, as a violin player, it's kind of like basically when I was growing up, it was just classical music, period. That was it. Yeah. Nobody was doing anything different. Nobody could teach anything different. And if you wanted to do anything different, you really had to figure it out all by yourself. So, yeah, that's pretty great to have that support because it took a long, long, long time for me to start playing jazz. You know, so to start with David Baker at that point, when you're little, that's what a blessing.
I do feel really lucky, and I'm almost certain that that opportunity would not have come about had we not lived in Bloomington and, you know, had David not been there. Because as you said, like at that time, those opportunities weren't necessarily available. It wasn't really until, I guess it was starting in basically like 95, 96, like the late 90s, when you started to see these opportunities for string practitioners of different styles coming together for summer workshops and those kinds of things where you'd start to see that, yeah, there are other styles of music that are played on these instruments. On string instruments. And, you know, so much of how we view the world is based on what we actually see and what we hear. And when we can see a bluegrass fiddler doing their thing, or we can see a jazz violinist doing their thing, or if we can, you know, just really witness up close and personal what that sounds like and what it feels like to be in a live performance hearing that stuff, then it really can change your trajectory with the music that you play.
At some point now, you got your double major degree. Mm-hmm. So you've got two bachelors of art, one in jazz and one in classical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I know that was even with all that exposure, that must have been tough.
You know, it surprisingly wasn't that bad because a lot of the requirements for the two degrees overlapped.
Okay.
So, you know, the music history was required for both classes, music theory, ear training, all those sorts of things were requirements for both degrees. So it wasn't really as big of an issue. Where it came to be a little complicated was with ensemble requirements and with recital requirements. So, for instance, you know, obviously there are a certain number of semesters that you'd have to be in an orchestra and a certain number of semesters you'd have to be in jazz band. And trying to figure that out was a bit of a logistical puzzle. But we did it. The administration, they were really great to work with as far as being flexible and doing what they could to try to make it work. Luckily, I wasn't the first person to go through doing something like that. So there was a bit of a precedence, but still, there's always a little bit of maneuvering that has to be done to kind of make that work. But, you know, I ended up taking some summer ensembles. So I could do orchestras during the summer. I would do jazz band during the year. And then during the course of the 4 years, I was doing some combos, small group jazz situations. And I was also doing string quartets and all that. So there was a lot on the plate as far as ensembles go, but in a way that was the most ideal because you're playing and you're collaborating with your colleagues. And yeah, I mean, it's what you want to be doing is learning through that kind of experience. So where there was double time, like as far as like double requirements, it was in classes where I was really wanting to be spending my time. So it was great.
Well, now the part that I'm like, my brain is switching and I'm like, I can't switch from classical to jazz and back again. Like really easily. I have to practice classical music to no end now because I haven't played it in so long. But even so, like how do you, because the sounds are so different. The attacks are so different. How do you do that? I mean, it's just because the classical is like on the beat and almost ahead of the beat. And the attacks are very pointed and very sharp and very bright. And I don't know, I have to actually play a different instrument when I do that because my setup is different. So I can't, and now it's like, I don't even like it anymore. I like listening to it. I don't like playing it.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's funny. I'm kind of in the same boat at this point because I don't really do much like straight up classical music anymore. Every once in a while, I'll have a gig that comes up, like a recording session, usually kind of like an orchestral situation or like a chamber ensemble sort of thing. And I do play with the New York Pops. I'm a member of that orchestra, but that they're doing more standards, you know, standards orchestrated for, you know, large ensemble. They're, every once in a while, we'll do like a John Williams tribute, which is a nightmare for me because it's like, like all 16ths and like total like insanity on the fingerboard. But so I'm out of practice doing that sort of thing. So yeah, I couldn't pick up and switch back and forth, I think, as easily as I used to. I think when I was younger, it wasn't such a big deal because of the fact that I'd grown up doing both. So I kind of see it as being someone being bilingual, mm-hmm. that they aren't necessarily thinking about speaking, say, in English and then switching over and speaking in Spanish. Like it's, you know, they've grown up with that soundtrack in their lives and it's just, it's a natural way of communicating. So the fact that when I was a kid, I was doing Suzuki violin, started when I was 5 and a half. And then I started doing Baroque lessons when I was maybe about 7 or 8. I think it was 8 years old or so.
It's like Baroque music, you mean? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So IU also has a really wonderful early music department. And so, and again, my father knew the head of the department. So, and my mom and dad are both musicologists. And so they had a really broad perspective musically in the world. And I wanted to make sure that both my sister and I had that same exposure because this is pre-internet. Like you can't just like, you know, kind of search up all those things in the click of a button. So yeah, I was doing Baroque violin lessons and I was also doing jazz violin lessons when I was around 8 or 9. So these things were all sort of just around me and it wasn't something where I was necessarily thinking about switching from style to style. I think as I've gotten older and I'm certainly, so now my music is more in the jazz realm. That said, classical music in as far as technique and musical development and all those things, it certainly is a part of what I do, but the actual art of performing classical repertoire I'm out of practice with it. So I couldn't switch back. And I've definitely taken this time where I've been focusing primarily on jazz music to really sort of fine tune a lot of the skills as you were talking about the idea of really finding that groove and that pocket and really being able to fine tune a lot of those things that might get blurred with, or might get diluted with like trying to do classical at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I can't switch back like I used to. Okay. I'm getting older. I can't do that anymore.
Well, I mean, it's just one. I'm always in awe of people because, like, I know Wynton Marsalis would always talk about that he would have to practice for months and months to do a classical gig, you know, and then he just stopped at some point. He just stuck with jazz, and I get it. It's such a huge push. So yeah, so I'm always in awe of people who can do both because I used to be able to do classical pretty well, but I was an orchestral player. I was never, you know, a soloist or anything like that. And that was part of it. It was like, we're going to play Brahms Fourth again. You know, it's like, I love Brahms Fourth, but,
yeah, of course.
But come on.
Yeah.
And I was always in the second violins and it's like, and that's okay.
Yeah, it's great.
You know, but it was just like, okay, and because I don't actually, I don't know why I'm a violin player. I should have been a bass player or a viola player because I don't like playing up in the stratosphere. I really don't like that. It's just too much. It's just way up here. My hands are huge, by the way. So it's like really hard, you know, to play like little teeny stuff that's this close together. Up I was like, what the heck?
You know, it's funny. Violin is my main instrument, but I recently acquired a Hardanger Demore, which is a variation of a modern invention and variation on the traditional Hardanger violin. So for your listeners who might not know, Hardanger is a Norwegian folk fiddle, and it has four strings on top that you play, just like you would a violin, but then it also has a set of sympathetic strings underneath that simply resonate with the vibrations of the instrument. So the result is that you get this really beautifully haunting resonance, and the tail of a note, like it just lasts forever. It's just, wow. It's really, really incredible. So it's meant for folk dances and like a lot of the folk music where you're creating drones and that sort of thing. And this particular instrument has five strings on top and five strings below. So the pitches and the resonance is somewhere, well, it's almost closer to a viola in tone.
Okay.
And it's been so much fun to explore because I'm so used to the stratosphere with the violin. So to have those lower pitches and just that fuller bodied tone and warmth is amazing. So I'm like, oh, this is kind of fun. Maybe I should have played viola instead.
I know. I've never actually picked up a viola, and I just go, I don't want to learn that. I'm just trying to figure this out still. So, you know, it's like, I've been playing violin now for 44 years.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. And I'm just like, okay. By now you think I should know something. But...
No, you know, I feel this way every time I pick up the instrument. I'm like, do we know each other? Like, are we friends? No, but, you know, because some days you pick up the fiddle and it's like you're just reconnecting with a part of your body. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. there's just, it's so connected. And then there are other days where you pick up the instrument and you're like, oh my God, have I forgotten everything I've learned for the past 40 years? But I don't know. It's, you know, there is such a beautiful connection that we have to these instruments, and you know, the fact that we've been playing them for so long, it's who we are. It's like, there's so much of that in those instruments, for better or for worse. And I don't know. I think we're very lucky to be string players and to be able to make the music that we make and express ourselves on those instruments, because they are so connected to the human voice, and you would not want to hear me sing. So I wouldn't have no career. But I love the fact that I can connect on and I can express myself on an instrument that has that ability to soar and sing as string instruments do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that I think on one of your recordings, you're playing mandolin now, too.
You went deep into the record. I've been playing a little bit of mandolin. I bought a mandolin about 20 years ago with the idea of strengthening my chordal understanding of the instrument. You know, since the mandolin is tuned the same way as the violin, it just seemed like a really cool way to visualize chord structures and have that be something that I would spend some time developing. That was the intent. Ended up sitting in my closet for a very long time. And then a friend of mine, you know, I was talking with them and I was like, I really want to start taking mandolin lessons. And so I started taking lessons with him. And then from that, one of the groups that I used to play with quite a lot called Rose and the Nightingale, the leader of the group was like, oh, we'd love to have that mandolin in the band just as an added voice.
Okay.
So I was like, all right, well, if you have some patience with me as I learn my way around this thing, you know, I'll do my best. So that's the only recording, that album that we did is the only recording that actually has me playing mandolin on it. You know, I should have probably used some of this COVID time to actually get a little more into it, but you know, there's only so many hours in the day, but I do love it. And it has definitely had an impact on how I visualize the fingerboard of the violin. Mm-hmm.
So. No, I did the same thing.
Oh yeah.
I used to work at a music store and then I just started buying instruments. I have a ukulele bass. I have a mandolin. I have a ukulele. I've got, you know, I played piano first. So piano and violin were always together. And I sing. So I said, well, I got three instruments. I'm good. But the mandolin is lovely because I just love that sound. And it's funny because I didn't start thinking about it. I heard a recording. I can't even remember who it was now, but it was a pop album and they had mandolin in the background and it had such a beautiful tone.
Wow.
On this mandolin. And I was like, that is hip. They were just playing these chords and it was just there. And it's the only song in the whole album that has mandolin, but it made such a huge difference. Paula Cole. It was Paula Cole. Ah.
She's great.
Yeah. And I was listening to something. And she had this mandolin thing. And I was like, that is hip. I got to figure that out. And I said, what is that? A mandolin? It was so. And then I thought, oh, I could learn chords this way. Even though I have piano, I learned classical piano. Yeah. So it's like a whole different world when you start trying to play jazz stuff.
So totally. But, yeah, it's funny. I learned how to. My mom was an organist and a pianist, and so she did her best to teach me how to play piano. But I had no skills with it whatsoever. She even gave up after a while. She was like, "Just play the fiddle." but I think there is a what's cool about us playing the mandolin is that we already have the
left hand
dexterity on the mandolin because of the fact that it's basically translated from the fiddle. So that made that exploration of chordal structures so much more approachable because it wasn't like I was having to actually learn the piano and then like sort of get, because I wasn't going to get any like fluidity with the piano. Whereas at least even if I can't get my right hand plucking technique great on the mandolin, at least I can lay out those things on the mandolin and see how they work. So
yeah, that piece, the pick is like, I don't know what the heck. I'm like, and you can't, I don't know. And then slurring, nope. Like you can't slur. So it's like, what the hell? How do I play these notes?
It did not go well. I did the best I could, but it was like, I'm never going to be a mandolin player. I know this. I'm not aspiring to be a Chris Thiele. That's just, we'll put it out there.
All right. So at least I know I'm not alone in that boat. Oh, that's funny. So tell me about working with, I know at some point you started working with Daryl Anger for a while. Weren't you on tour with him for a little while?
Yeah, that's another throwback. Yeah, I met him, must have been back in 92 or 93. My sister was taking a summer during like her, I think it was, I don't know, somewhere in her college career. She took a summer to go to a variety of jazz camps. And one of the jazz camps that she went to was the Stanford Jazz Workshop. And I was talking with my boyfriend about this. I don't remember if I was there as a camper or if I just kind of went there to audit and just kind of hang out with my sister. So I think it was like a freshman or sophomore in high school at the time. And Daryl and the Turtle on the String Quartet, they were there at that workshop teaching. And so that was my first time meeting Daryl and Mark Summer and those guys. And it was great. I immediately connected with Daryl. I actually had like a little crush on him for a while. I just thought he was so cool. He was just, you know, this really like just happy guy who was playing fiddle in the most unreal ways, like just so inspirational. And so I got to meet him there. And then a few years later, he was putting together a touring project called Four Generations of Jazz Violin. And so I think we did a handful of concerts. The membership of that group kind of rotated based on people's availability, but Daryl was always there. Mm-hmm. I think Matt Glazer was part of a few shows. Johnny Frigo was part of a few shows. Claude Williams did them as well. Wow. I was part of the younger generation. And then Regina Carter did a few as well.
Okay.
So she and I were representing the younger generation. And so we never actually did a concert together. It was one of those things where we were like waving from afar because we were both part of the same project, but we never actually did them together. But yeah, so we did a few concerts there together through that. And yeah, that was that. And then I've reconnected with Daryl just a few years ago when we were both teaching at Berkeley together. So yeah, the stint that I did with Daryl was brief, but it was a really fun project, and really having the opportunity to be around him was awesome. I mean, we also ran into each other every summer teaching at Mark O'Connor's fiddle camps. So that was happening from, the camp started in 95. I started teaching there when I guess it was in 98 and taught there for about, God, it was close to 20 years straight. And Daryl was there almost every single camp. I mean, like the camp would actually have two different sessions. And so sometimes we were at the same session, sometimes we were at different ones, but we would oftentimes see each other at those camps and would have a chance to jam at those sessions as well. So Daryl has been one of those guys who's been present in my musical journey, whether it's directly or indirectly, he's always been there. He's just been a presence from pretty much from when I was in high school on. So an amazing guy. I'm sure you know him well. He's just really awesome.
Well, I know his work. I got to do a workshop with him in New York. I used to study with Julie Lyon Lieberman in New York. And she used to host him and he would come to do a workshop with the students. So I had one workshop with him and he was, you know, chopping and we were like looking at him like, what?
That's another skill I need to work on.
Yeah, me too. It's on the list.
Yeah. The COVID list.
So that, he's amazing. Enjoyed his work for many, many years. But now when you were playing with all these folks, you're just a youngin', basically. And you're coming up and you're like, hey, I'm touring with you guys. Was any of this intimidating to you at all?
Oh, yeah. No, and, you know, the funny thing, too, I mean, I'm trying to get better at it. But I was very much an introvert at the time as well. I was a shy kid, you know. I've always felt completely myself when I was playing music, but if I was actually interacting with them using words, I was screwed. I was just, and partially it was just being in awe of the people I was surrounded by, you know, these veterans and these legends in the field that I was having a chance to make music with. And that was, I knew it was an opportunity to really to cherish and to, you know, just live as much as I could, but I was also a little bit nervous and scared of the whole thing as well. But you know, what was wonderful about those guys is that they were all so supportive and so nurturing, like just really supporting me and giving me all kinds of encouragement in what I was pursuing and really just giving me the confidence to pursue what I was wanting to do. And, you know, it's a journey, it's a process, but I think to have those figures in my corner to give me that little nudge and that little push forward and to, you know, just knowing that they're there to support me was really super important for me and my development.
Oh, so getting these gigs, like, how did these happen? Did you go out looking for gigs or did people just come to you? Or, 'cause I know, as a jazz violinist, quote unquote, improvising violinist, I always had to be a leader. I always had to start my own bands. I never got called for side gigs ever. It just didn't happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the initial work that I was doing, I mean, I was doing in my hometown, in Bloomington, most of the gigs I was doing were ones that I led. Yep. So, you know, doing concerts at a couple of venues in town and taking part in concert series around the state. Those were things that I almost always was leading. When I was getting ready to move, or was considering moving to New York, actually, I guess it was my first big sort of the moment where I kind of like was considering moving to New York. I connected with Skitch Henderson, and this was a connection that I actually made through Matt Glazer. Matt was the one who Matt got hired to do this session with Skitch Henderson. Skitch Henderson, for the listeners who might not know, he was, well, just an amazing conductor, pianist, musical director. He was the band leader for The Tonight Show when Steve Allen was at the helm, and then was there with Johnny Carson for a bit as well. And he was like, he was Frank Sinatra. What was it? I think he was working with Bing Crosby on piano for a while. I think he also did some work with Frank Sinatra, if I'm not mistaken. Judy Garland, Mel Torme. Like he was just, you know, he was on the MGM studio grounds all the time, like just like helping out with a lot of those, mm-hmm. those movie productions. But toward the latter part of his life, he founded and directed the New York Pops. And that was kind of his project in his retirement. And so he did an album that Matt Glazer was contracted to put together a string quartet for, and Matt called me up. And so, yeah, I was part of that session, and Bucky Pizzarelli was there, Gene Bertoncini, a lot of these just terrific musicians that were part of Skitch's world. And so I had a good relationship with Skitch from that session, and he started to hire me and bring me out to New York to do a lot of things. And it was as a member of his band. Ah. So it was like, I was a sideman in someone else's group. And that was sort of my first real experience, sort of like being a sideman and really just having the opportunity to be part of a crew. Once I actually moved to New York, then, you know, I did a handful of gigs on my own, but a lot of the work I was getting was from other leaders who were wanting to incorporate a violin, just the violin sound into their ensembles. So those were calls that I was getting, and it was really great. I mean, like the big gig that I had, actually there were a couple. So one was with Mark O'Connor's American String Celebration. That was my first real touring experience where we got, you know, we're in a rental bus, like a touring bus, and doing the whole sleeper camper things. And it was Mark's tour. But there were a batch of string players. We were all part of, like, contributing members of the group. So that was my first real touring experience. We did that for about a year. But the really big touring experience I had as a sideman was with Esperanza Spalding. And that was from 2010 until 2012. And
oh, again, wow, that long.
It was 2 years of touring that album.
Okay.
And that was, again, like, I was part of the band. It was her music. It was her repertoire. And, you know, and so from that, there were, you know, a sideman with some different vocalists that you know, I gotten to know over the years, some instrumentalists as well, who are maybe doing larger ensembles, and they had like a string duo, string trio that were part of the ensemble. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it just kind of snowballed in a way, to the point where essentially I could, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, the bulk of the work that I've been doing has been as a sideman, just, you know, playing with these groups. In the last 2 or 3 years, it's been like, I really want to be doing more of my own thing. I mean, I love the sideman work, so that's always going to be something that is a part of my career. And that's where I've grown so much with, like, you know, having my ears expanded and my technique expanded. But I do have repertoire that I've developed and written and arranged that I want to, you know, start putting out in the world again. So it's trying to strike a little bit more of a balance between the two. But yeah, being a sideman for these last 10 years has been just such an eye-opening experience, and one that I'm super grateful for, because It's just opened my eyes to so many different things, from performance to technique to pedagogy to touring to all of it. And, you know, it's been really, really valuable.
Huh. Now, it's one of those things, I've just never done a lot of touring. I toured a little bit with a dance troupe, which was really fun to do. I'd like to do that some more, but that's pretty much it. I didn't really do tours. I, you know, basically was always leading a band. So it was, yes. So that experience, I'm envious of that. So it's like, I'm glad somebody's doing it, you know, so that people can say, hey, look, you can put a fiddle in there.
More
so,
fiddle.
Yeah. It's like, I'm glad that you're doing it, because it really does open people's minds, because they don't book what they don't see.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, that is one of the things that's been difficult with COVID, is not traveling, because mm-hmm. that's been something that I do love to do. And I've been fortunate, you know, I haven't been part of like many big tours, like multi-year tours. The Esperanza thing was certainly one. And then the other one was David Krakauer's big picture. That was something I did for about a year, but it wasn't like the entire year was blocked off for that stuff. It was usually like 1 or 2 weeks, but I love that kind of travel. You know, I love performing with people. I love seeing the world. I love having a chance to, you know, I'm one of those travelers, like when we're in a city for a day, like I get up really early and I put on my walking shoes and I'm out exploring and checking out the sights and the sounds and the tastes of these different places. And then coming back to the hotel and getting ready for the show, and then really putting all of my energy and my focus and my experience into that moment. And yeah, I miss that. You know, I miss, as we all do, you know, it's just the some of the challenges that have come out of something that we never thought would actually happen. Like, we always assume there are going to be gigs, there'll be performance opportunities, right, and venues and festivals, like, because none of us have lived in a time where that hasn't been part of our norm, mm-hmm. In our everyday. And to actually, for all of us to experience this year where suddenly the opportunity to really craft and create and do what we love to do, that's just not a choice. You know, it's right. Like we have to just hang out until this whole thing blows over.
Well, like, so have you been teaching, doing a lot of online teaching and things like that during this? Or are you still at Berkeley teaching?
Yes. I've been teaching at Berkeley since fall of 2015. It's been wonderful. The department, you know, it's one of these situations where, because the improvising string world is still fairly small, at least the ones who, like, those of us who've been around for a little bit, I joined the faculty and I was like, I know everybody here. This is great. Like, I've known you guys for like 20 years. This is right. Cool. And like, I'm homecoming of sorts. It's a small department, probably about 20 of us. When you compare it with other departments in Berkeley, like, you know, they're like 80 or 90 like based instructors, or I mean, it's not quite that many, but they're like, I think they're like maybe 60 guitar instructors or something there. I mean, it's just kind of crazy, but yeah, I love the department. I love our students. It's really genuinely a family, unlike anything I've really experienced before with the school. So it's been very cool to be part of that. And certainly, you know, to be hearing both from the faculty and students, such inspirational ideas in both performance and pedagogy. It's been an eye-opening experience, and I feel very lucky to be there.
So do you get together with any of the other professors or to do any music, or do you just teach, like, you know, before COVID?
Yeah. So before COVID, I would go up. So Berklee, of course, is in Boston. So I would go up super early on Monday mornings. Like, I think my alarm was set for like 4:45. It was like super early. Travel up there, and it's a 4-hour train ride. Get up there and teach usually for about 4 to 5 hours. And then I basically turn right back around and mm-hmm. come home. So the unfortunate thing, at least with my schedule, what my schedule has been in the past, is that because I'm just there for a day, I don't really have as much of a chance to interact with the faculty on a regular basis. But what's cool is that throughout the semester, there are various times for us to collaborate. Like, there'll be a jazz violin summit concert. So, you know, certain, like, select number of faculty and I will get together and put together a program and perform with the students as well. Yeah. So there'll be select opportunities for us to do, you know, different collaborations in that way. We're always getting together for string department meetings weekly. So there's a chance to certainly exchange ideas in that capacity about what we're doing, different ideas that we have, things that are working, things that aren't. Yeah. I mean, I would certainly love to be able to actually jam and play with everybody on a more regular basis, but at least the structure of things right now, that's not kind of how my schedule is set up. But, you know, that's one of the cool things, is that I, you know, maybe down the line, I might end up deciding to lead an ensemble there, and to actually, like, you know, maybe do it like an, I don't, I've thought about some different ensemble ideas that could work. And that might happen down the line, you know, and that'll be more of a chance for me to collaborate with the students in, you know, in that capacity. But for right now, I'm just teaching privately, and that's been, it's been a good balance for me as far as doing what I love as a teacher, but then also being able to be available for the gigging and touring that I like to do as well.
When you're teaching your students, I mean, what do you try to get from them? Like, what is one of your teaching, I don't know, credos? What, like, your philosophy, what do you really think about teaching? What are you trying to get from that student?
That's a good question. Oh. You know, I think about my dad a lot when I teach. And my dad was just an incredible professor. Was one of those folk who, you know, he wasn't scared to make a fool of himself if that meant making the students feel comfortable and enjoy the process of learning and really begin to think about what it is that they do and what they say, and just becoming much more engaged in the learning process and just finding that fire and excitement that comes with expanding your mind. And I think, so I'm one of those teachers, I don't have a problem like just being silly and being a goof if that means that my students are going to enjoy making music and are going to feel comfortable enough to explore new things. Or explore things that they've been wanting to learn about, but have been too frightened or too, I don't know, just don't feel that they don't have enough confidence to do it. So my goal is to teach each student, like, to teach who they are, like to learn who they are and to teach them. I always am a little, I see this, and I'm sure you do too, teachers who just sort of teach the same curriculum. Yeah. Like, so it doesn't matter who the student is, who's in their studio. Like, it's the same stuff, same exercises, and sort of like, you know, it's the same lesson plan from student to student. And I've seen professors do that too. And of course it's harder in a large class setting, but I've seen teachers who've succeeded in overcoming that and like, or diverting that and really learned who their students are and have really connected with them in that way. So, you know, I want my students to leave Berklee feeling that they were understood. And that their artistic vision was that it was also understood, but we were there to guide them and help them and perhaps enlighten them to some different things that could be part of it. So, yeah, I just want to connect with them. I want them to feel that they're seen, that they're heard, and that I, yeah, was able to help in that journey in some way, just helping them feel that they have helping them to find their voice and their grounding for it.
How would you compare your studies, your personal studies, compared to what kids are getting now at like Berklee? Like, is it a whole different world, or is it very similar, or is it more expanded now because of the internet, or what do you, you know?
You know, it's different, and there are a lot of things that are different. I think technology has certainly, like, the learning tools, the teaching tools that we have available to us are wonderful assets to have. You know, for me, I don't play piano very well at all. So it was when I was growing up, I was very much reliant on either my mom playing piano with me or Jamie Abersole was coming up with those play alongs at the time.
Love so that
was
Jamie Abersole.
Those were lifesavers for me because it was just a chance to actually play when I couldn't play with anybody necessarily. But now, you know, it's, you know, there's so many different jamming platforms for students that you can modify tempo, speed, keys, all that kind of stuff. It's a very, there's a lot of learning tools out there that make the absorption process easier in that way. But at the same time, it still comes down to the same kind of fundamentals, listening and practicing. You know, like there's no technology that can expedite the absorption process and the sweat and the tears that you put into learning your craft.
Right.
Like that's just hours in the room, practice room, learning. And you can certainly take advantage of these tools that will help with that process, but it still comes down to you picking up your instrument, practicing your scales, getting your technique down, transcribing solos, and practicing licks and you know, harmonic sequences, all those kinds of things that are just part of the learning tradition. So there are some things that are very different, but there are some things that are just going to always be part of that infrastructure. I think what's unique about what Berklee is doing, which was not, I mean, I'm only starting to see kind of pop up, just been happening within the last few years, is the sort of the variety of music that is now being taught in these schools. Mm-hmm. Like when I came up, it was just classical, and there were some jazz programs that were being developed. But even at that time, there were like, it wasn't a universal thing. It wasn't like if you have a music school, you have a jazz department. It was like you have a classical department, and maybe you'll have a jazz department. Now, like pretty much every school, if it has a strong music school, has a jazz department. And, you know, and then you're starting to see, this has been really wild. I've been doing some residencies over the years at some smaller schools, smaller colleges around the U.S. And it's so enlightening to see that there are a lot of smaller schools that maybe don't have a huge music department, but they, because of the fact that maybe it's smaller, they have a quicker ability to change and adapt to what the students are wanting. Mm-hmm. So like students are saying, you know, I want to learn more about this style of music or that style of music, or I want to learn more about recording and recording technology. I want to learn more about, you know, tour managing and all this. So these professors and these deans of these departments are seeking experts in these fields to come and teach for their school or do residencies. So even the most like remote school, because of these technological advances and, you know, just grants and that, those kinds of things, are able to really be in a lot of ways be more at the forefront of giving their students a much more diversified musical education than some of the institutions that are so ingrained in tradition that they have a harder time sort of expanding to include different styles of music like bluegrass and hip hop and rock and Hungarian music and, you know, Indian music, which are the kinds of things that Berklee is offering in their infrastructure. So
I know some of the people who work at Berklee, and everybody's so adjunct, so I don't ever know if anybody knows anybody else. But, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you teach there too, because I know Mimi Jones teaches bass there. Some people that used to teach there don't teach there anymore, but, you know, Christian Karam is still there. It's just different styles, different, I don't know. It's just so fun to see all of this intermeshing happening.
I know. It really is. Yeah. And I think what Berklee is able to do that a lot of schools haven't done as well. Yes, there are a lot of adjunct faculty there, as there are with most of these schools. Like when you look at Juilliard and you look at Manhattan School and New School, I don't have the stats in front of me, but I wouldn't be surprised if, like, you know, it's a large number of adjuncts. But what Berklee has been able to do through, you know, the division, through departments and like departmental meetings and all this, like on a regular basis, that is a way of creating community. But then there's also, they do various events throughout the year that are for the entire school. So there's a thing they call opening day, where like for a day, there's a keynote speaker, and then there are, like, you know, as all the faculty, full-time and part-time, can take part in these classes that are taught by Berklee faculty. And it's just a chance to get to know other people in the school and learn from your colleagues. And they do that in the spring as well. So it just happened last week. It's called Be Taught. So it's Berklee Teachers on Teaching. Oh, and it's 2 days where we just get together, we hang out, listen to a couple keynote addresses, and then there are 3 different classes that take place throughout the day. And, you know, each hour we have a chance to take, like, we have a choice of like 10 classes and that are taught by our colleagues. And we have a chance to learn from them and get to know them and interact with them. So there's a real, like during regular times, we'll actually do that on Berkeley's campus. So there's a chance for all of us to be like just the teachers to hang out for a couple days and to have lunch and dinner together and to learn from each other and listen to concerts. And it's just, it's a chance for us all to connect and really feel there's a community there. So it's a cool thing. Very cool.
Yeah. It sounds like a beautiful thing. Yeah. I applied to Berkeley for a master's program a couple of years ago, but I don't think I fit into the grouping of students that they have because I'm way too old and have way too much experience, I think.
You could be teaching the classes.
Yeah. Most of the people who were interviewing me, there was like this huge band of people, you know, like Danilo Perez and and all these other folks. And I'm like, I'm the same age as they are. So they were like, you're not going to fit into this. And I'm like, dude, I do this all the time. But, you know, it was kind of like, well, you know, I just figured I'd give it a shot because I never got to go to school for music. So I always wanted to do it. And I figured, well, I'm getting older, so I better try. And I thought, well, Berkeley is where all this stuff is happening and there all these different styles are coming together. And that's where I want to be.
Yeah,
but it just didn't work out. But I really do think it was more of I just had more experience than the students who were there because they were all in their 20s. I'm like, I'm in my 50s. So, you know, it's going to be harder, I guess. But I don't know. I go into a room all the time if I wish COVID was over. But, you know, that's what I do. I mean, I follow the Rhiannon and the Bobby McFerrin technique. And we go in and say, you sing that, you sing that, you sing that, you play that, I'll play this and start, go. And that's how, you know, so it doesn't matter what age you are, you know, it's like, I think we can figure it out as musicians.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's another thing too, is that, you know, of course we do put a lot of value in the idea of what schooling can offer, like as far as that kind of, that background, but you know, the schooling isn't everything, you know, it's, and I know so many musicians who they got their degree in like architecture.
Yeah.
And then they ended up being a musician because it was just so much a passion for them that, you know, so they don't have any like formal training, but they're such incredible musicians. And like, I hear your stuff and it's just like, it's amazing. And it's not something that you necessarily have to be taught in school to do.
It's one of those things, thank you, by the way, it's one of those things where I just want to have the time with people on an ongoing basis so that we can like, I can like stretch myself.
Yeah.
Because after a while, it just sounds like me. You know, I want to have other people to say, well, I'm going to throw this in. And they're like, huh, I never heard that before. How do you do that? And have some dialogue and have some interaction. And then when you're at home playing in your closet, you know, it's just like, okay, I'm so done with me.
It's interesting. I've talked with some of my students who are adults, you know, approaching this music. And that's been the biggest hurdle is like, how do I, you know, I'm learning this stuff, I'm practicing it, I need to actually apply it in real life. And I'm not necessarily ready to be doing gigs, but I want to have a chance to like regularly play with people. And, you know, it's been a challenge either to get a group where you feel as though all the levels are pretty much, you know, a similar place. But, you know, somehow, I don't know, you put enough feelers out there that you end up finding a way of sort of exercising those things and like, or with like with a band that you have or bands that you have, like just making a point to not to get together to practice for a gig necessarily, but just to get together to try stuff out and just to, for all of you, like to say, okay, like everybody bring a tune or two and let's try some stuff out and just workshop stuff. And, you know, and you know what a lot of my friends here do in the city, at least you know, when things aren't shut down, is they do sessions, you know, and that's been a big way of networking too. It's, you know, they just call up, you know, a drummer and a bassist and do sessions. They just play tunes and it could be things that are like standards or it could be things that people are writing, but it's just that chance to interact and to expand your ears and have a chance to play. So,
yeah, it's tricky. I lived up in Lansing for like 10 years too, before I moved back down to Detroit area. So I just came back here about 3 years ago into the actual Detroit, Metro Detroit area. And I joined Art Collective down here, and I had a spot where I could do like once a week, I had a spot to do whatever I wanted. So I started something, I called it the Woodshed. And so I said, I put up and I said, we're going to do these three tunes, show up. You know, I got one person to come once. I did it for like a month. What? You know, I did it like, I was there every like Tuesday night or something, nothing. And I was like, I don't know how to get people to, you know, and maybe it's because I'm a violin player, you know, it's like, and I'm not well known. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know. So it's like, I tried. I'm going to keep trying. I mean, now COVID hit and everything, but it's one of those things. Now I'm just like, okay, well, we're not going to do that. Maybe I will just reach out to people individually and just say, I want to do this. Do you want to do this with me? I don't know. I don't know if there's levels, because there's levels in the professional world too. Like some people just won't do anything unless it's paid. And then other people are like, yeah, I could do that. I just don't have any time. Or, you know, folks like me that I don't have any time anymore because I keep creating, none of that was working. So I created a podcast, you know, so now that takes up a lot more time. I actually don't have a lot of time to practice at all because I'm doing this and I also have a full-time job. So it's, you know, it's
a lot.
You got to feed yourself, but it's just interesting how the world is changing and how we're having to adapt into things that I would never thought of having a podcast in the past. You know, it's just like, are you kidding? And then, you know, COVID hit and I said, okay, I've been thinking about doing it. I did have a radio show for a very short time for like a year or two back in the 90s at the community college in Lansing, Michigan. So I have done this, but it wasn't with any guests. It was just literally putting on a CD and saying, now that was, you know, Steph Smith playing, you know, and that was it. So that was pretty simple. This is a little bit more in depth. So it's kind of funny how just things are shifting and I'm just digressing all over the place. Rabbit holing. Okay.
No, but it's interesting how like the paths and the journeys that we all take and especially during this year, like what sort of things have been revealed. I wonder, kind of going back to what you were talking about with trying to get people together to play, I wonder how this whole experience is going to change that, you know, because suddenly people are not going to be maybe quite as stuck on the idea like of getting together with people to play and have there be a paycheck at the end of it. There's going to be a lot more gratitude with the idea like we can actually get together in a room and play and not have to worry about like putting hand sanitizer on everything and, you know, just like we can actually just be in a room together and make music and experiment with stuff. And I hope anyway that at least as far as us creating and working in our craft, that there's going to be a little more flexibility with that kind of stuff. And people are going to be like, yeah, I'd love to get together and play. Let's get together and jam. And have that be something that.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah.
So your sister, Rachel, right? So you two have gotten together and recorded together, which I think is pretty amazing because are there only two of you in the family or are there other siblings?
So it's two of us. We have three half siblings, but as far as like like our unit that like was as a kid growing up, it was just me and my sister. So yeah, so we grew up playing music together all the time. She used to play cello. That was her instrument. So it was violin, cello, and my mom played piano. And so yeah, so we were doing string trios all the time. My dad was our biggest fan, listening to us practice. So we've played music together since we were little kids. And then when she finished she did an undergrad, a double undergrad as well. She did it in classical cello and jazz cello. I know, that was pretty amazing. So she did that, but then basically once she finished her undergrad, she knew that jazz was her sort of her stylistic realm, but she wasn't convinced that cello was her actual voice. She just didn't necessarily have that same connection that to that instrument that I had to the violin. So she ended up actually switching to voice, you know, vocalist. And that was where she really just took off. Like where like, it was, she found her musical instrument. And so then after she took a year off from school to kind of like make that transition, to get some vocal instruction, get things going. And then she ended up moving to Boston for 3 years where she did her master's in jazz voice at a New England conservatory. Mm-hmm. So Yeah, so it was a switch going from playing classical trios with her to playing in jazz quartets with her, with her singing. But at this, that musical connection is always there. And it was just a matter of adapting what we were doing to that particular medium. I love playing with her. It's like that ability. It's kind of like, I guess, what twins in a way talk about, like, as far as like just connecting with each other and really having there be a different level of communication that's there. And we've always felt that when we make music together, that we read each other really well. We feel a lot of these musical ideas and expressions in the same way. And that's always been a real joy to be able to do that with her.
Fantastic. I'm glad that you're able to do that. My sister's a singer as well. And we're completely different styles. She's more gospel and R&B. So it's kind of like, okay, I wrote a gospel tune for her. We got to perform it one time at the Brooklyn Conservatory of Music back in 2005.
Yeah.
And that was a gigantic ensemble. I had six voices and I had a seven-piece band. And so like, if we ever get to record this piece, it's going to be this huge production number. Really want to. So it's just kind of one of those things, but to do a project together like that it'd be difficult, because it just is. Because in order for me to really encapsulate the voice that she has, it needs to be supported in the right way. So, and just writing the one piece, it's not like I write a lot of stuff. I write here and there. And that was, that was one of my good ones. So I have to I would like to get it produced. But yeah, and then, then I have my aunt is a jazz singer. My mom sings classically. I have two cousins, first cousin and his son, Michael and Michael Hannah. They're Sir Roland Hannah's kid and grandkid.
Got it.
So they're both singers. And then I have my nephew, the singer's son is a DJ. So it's like we're trying. I want to do a family album, but
yeah, you need to. You got the whole band.
It's kind of nuts. It's insane. We've been all thinking about how to do it for years, because everybody's styles are so different, and this would be the funkiest album ever.
It's so great. Wow. I love those collaborations where you have people who are coming from such different traditions and they find their musical voice. They find that thread that really makes something like that work. And it's awesome. It's all within your own family. Love it.
Yeah. So that, it's a dream. We'll see if I can make it happen at some point, because somebody has to steer it. And I know if it's going to happen, I'll probably be the one. And I'm just like, okay, you do this, you do that. Aww. And that's do I want to take that on? I don't know. So,
but it'll be worth it in the end, for sure.
In the end. Yeah. So it's one of those things. And so tell me, another groundbreaking thing for you is that Grammy nominated Chuck Owen. So how did that recording session even come about? And then your solo gets Grammy nominated, just the solo.
Yeah, that whole thing was just very unexpected. So that was another sideman gig. Chuck Owen is a really amazing composer and arranger based in Tampa, Florida. And our paths had crossed a few points over the years, like at jazz conferences. And I think I came down to do a workshop at USF where he just retired from USF this semester, but he'd been there for 40 years. And I did a concert there in 2000, and he was kind of there overseeing my residency and helping out helping out on piano. But we never really interacted much until, collaborated much until I think it was 2008 or 2009. Manhattan School of Music was performing, the Jazz Philharmonic was performing one of his pieces that he'd written for his, the Jazz Surge, which is his big band, plus orchestra. This was a kind of a unique situation. And so they brought me on board. So the piece itself features tenor, guitar, and violin. And I'm on faculty at Manhattan School of Music as well. And so they featured me and Jack Wilkins on guitar, mm-hmm. and Donnie McCaslin on tenor. And so that was the first time I actually had a chance to really work with Chuck on this piece, because he flew up from Tampa and helped coach the orchestra and was kind of there to oversee some of the final rehearsals and then to be there for the performance. And from that point on, it was we really hit it off, and he expressed interest in having me be a member of his Jazz Surge Ensemble. So I was like, yeah, I would love it. Sign me up. And so shortly thereafter, well, I guess a few years later, the assembly of this album, Whispers in the Wind, came into the conversation. And so he'd written the whole thing out. So it's for big band plus, the Jazz Surge for him is big band plus violin. And usually he has two guitar players who are usually part of the ensemble as well. So slightly expanded. With this album in particular, he was bringing Randy Brecker on as a featured soloist. Cool. And Gregoire Moret on harmonica. And so those were the two featured soloists and then the entire band. And then I was part of that band. Anyway, so the band recorded their tracks and then he flew me in later to overdub my parts. To all the stuff. I mean, all of it was orchestrated with my part included, but it just wasn't going to work for me to fly down and record with the band at the same time. But yeah, he gave me a couple solos on the album, which was awesome. It was really nice of him to do that. And I did the recording and then, you know, said goodbye and onward. And then I got an email from him not too long after saying, hey, the album is done. We're getting ready to submit it for Grammy consideration. And is it okay if I include your solo on this track as one of the possible Grammy things? I was like, my God, wow, thank you. That's amazing. That was really awesome. But I didn't think of it after that because of the fact that hundreds of solos get submitted for Grammy consideration. So you never know. And it's like a needle in a haystack kind of thing. And certainly my name is not one that's very well known to, you know, certainly enough to get any like notable attention. So yeah, didn't think anything about it. And then I was at Berkeley teaching. I just finished teaching. It was a Tuesday morning. I was getting ready to go back to New York. And this was in November of 2017. And I'm standing in line at a coffee shop and I get this text from a friend and he's like, Sarah, congratulations. We're so excited for you. And I was like, huh? So I wrote him back literally like, what are you talking about? And he's like, you don't know. I was like, no. And so then he sent me over the link that had all the Grammy nominees listed. Mm-hmm. And there my name was. There were five of us and with the improvised solo. And I screamed so loud in the cafe. I was like, whoa, what just happened? And I was, oh God, it was just such an unbelievable thing that all that came to happen. And yeah, it, like that whole period from like November through the Grammys in a couple months later, it was just so surreal to be part of that experience and just to have that happen. So it's very much burned in my brain.
Well, did you get to go to the ceremony at all? Or?
Yeah. And the funny thing was that was the first year the Grammys had been held in New York in like years. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It had been decades, I think, since it had been held in New York. So it was great for me because I, you know, it was like three subway stops away instead of having to stay over and like fly to LA and get a hotel rental. So it was actually really cool. So my mom flew in for the ceremony and one of my good friends, her husband, was also nominated for a Grammy. So we decided that the easiest way to do this was to meet on the corner of 96th and Broadway, like all dressed up in our gowns and like everything. And to take the subway down to Madison Square Garden, because the you know, road, like there's no way we're going to find parking down there.
Right,
it's like,
right.
And, you know, like, and for cars, like taxis or anything to get through to the, there's no way. Everything was barricaded. So we're like, well, the easiest, most direct way to do this is just to get on the subway. So we get on the subway, we're like, and we're in these amazing, like, you know, super dressed up ball gowns. Sure. And everyone on the subway is just like, what the, you know? And we're just like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. But at the same time, it was awesome. It's like, this is how you do the Grammys in New York. But it was, yeah, it was really amazing. So, you know, it was having it there in the city and just to kind of experience it from, you know, my backyard was really awesome. So,
oh, so fantastic. I'm glad you had that opportunity to experience that. That's very cool. You know, it's like, you know, I could see, you know, you get on the subway and you've got your gown on and you just have to look down your nose a little bit and say, yes, can I help you?
I have to get to this point somehow.
Fantastic. Really great. Really great. Where online can people find you?
Yeah, so they can find me on Facebook and Instagram. That's where I do most of my social media posting. I have a Twitter account. I check it, but I'm not great about posting on it. But yeah, Facebook and Instagram are where I hang for the most part. And then my website's going through some revisions now, but it's, you know, sarahcaswell.com. It's S-A-R-A, no H, sarahcaswell.com. And once things get back up and running, I'll have my gigs posted there and different projects and news of note. Right now, I have a project. It's my first solo project in like close to 15 years. Mm. I did one with my sister back in 2013 with Fred Hirsch, but this one is my first solo project in 15 years. And the plan had been to release it this year, but with COVID, I didn't really feel it made sense to release it if I couldn't actually do any performances to support it. So kind of feeling things out, I'd like to release it this year. You know, the touring thing is still very much, if things resume, as you know, it's probably not going to be until the fall when mm-hmm. venues open up again. But I just want to get that material out so I can share it with people and you know, keep moving forward. So I'll have those kinds of things posted on my website. There'll be news about the release date and such. So,
well, thank you so much, Sarah, for, you know, allowing me to come into your home and speak with you and sharing your heart and your goals and your dreams and your past and your journey and just all the exciting things that are Sarah Caswell. So thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been such a joy to talk with you and to finally like really like, you know, talk face to face and yeah, just to yeah, to feel your energy and good vibes and all that. It's been really, really awesome talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website, tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate your comments and will mind them to bring you more amazing episodes.
I would like to thank this inaugural season sponsors, the folks at Jazz Alliance of Bend, Michigan, or JAM. Michigan Art Share, a program of Michigan State University Extension, is a partner in supporting the Tia Time podcast and Sham Bones Music. Without their support, this podcast would not be possible. Thank you so much. If you would also like to contribute to the show, you can find us on patreon.com.
If you want to continue the conversation about topics discussed in the show or start new ones with like-minded people, join us at the Tia Time Lounge on Facebook. Thank you for listening. See you next week at Tia Time.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tia Time.